it's me, Seth.
Well, for an hour, I am your host. For the next hour, with 1001 songs, the great songs of all time, and the artist's stories and the secrets behind them, as selected by the Australian music journalist Toby Cresswell. Now, as usual, I like to say what Toby Cresswell was sort of getting up to here in this concept book. You know, the idea behind his artistic integrity here was not to create the best songs of all time as such, but more a case of creating a list of the songs that he thought were most influential, you know, in the last 100 or so years of music. Not reflecting particularly, I mean, some of these songs, he says as himself, some of these songs are truly awful. Now, I'll leave you to make up your own mind about this particular song. I've got John Cale here, and Fear is a Man's Best Friend.
Waiting's killing me. It's wearing me down. Day in, day out. My feet are burning holes in the ground. Warmer than a bedroom floor. Want someone to hold me close forevermore. I'm a sleeping dog, but you can't tell when I'm on the prowl. You better run like hell. You know it makes sense.
Just do when you're born. Say, fear's a man.
John Cale there, and a friend is a man's best fear, or something like that. You're with Waiheke Radio here, 88.3 and 107.4 on this really quite beautiful and ever-darkening Monday evening up here at Waiheke Radio. I'm Seth, and this is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists' stories and the secrets behind them. That was John Cale and Friends of the Man... well, you know, something like that. Something about friends and men and fear and various words like that that I can't actually get into the right order this evening, which is lovely. But it says here that having made his pop album Paris 1919 in Los Angeles... John Cale went to London to make a rock album. His credibility as former member of the Velvet Underground stood the Welsh singer-songwriter in good stead. Roxy Music's Brian Eno, actually I think we've got some of him coming up, maybe not next week, but in coming weeks, listen to some very long, drawn-out, ambient music for Earports, Brian Eno. I don't know how that appeals to you, but at any rate, guitarist Phil Manzanera and saxophonist Andy Mackay came on board, as did the session guitarist Chris Spedding. The sound they made with Cale was the dark side of glam rock. Soft Machine's Kevin Ayers had recently staged the Super Art Rock concert featuring Eno, Cale himself and Nico. That is captured on this album, June 1st, 1974. That concert shows some of the level of paranoia and violence that was part of Cale's repertoire at the time. He was doing a lot of dope and drinking, as he says here. The first track on the Fear album shows the shape of things to come. Fear is a man's best friend, is an idea, wrote Cale in his autobiography. It's about paranoia! Oh no, he's Welsh, isn't it? I don't think I'm up to doing a Welsh accent this evening, but anyway, he said it's not the sort of thing that you can say it's true or false. It's more dialectic, a position where you can or you can't take. The song swings between high and low like a lurching, bouncing ball of angst. Gentle piano riffs gradually become more and more intense and erratic as the song builds up into a frenzy of paranoia and aggression. Fear is a Man's Best Friend wasn't going to be a pop single, but it set the agenda for the next decade of Cale's work and for much of the British art music establishment. You can, you'll be listening to us on 88.3 or 107.4 FM, or possibly, potentially, you might be listening to us live streaming on waihikiradio.org.nz/listen. Up next, we've got the Beastie Boys with Fight For Your Right. And that was the Beastie Boys and Fight for Your Right, open brackets to party, close brackets, as it says, quite literally, on the thing here. That appears on License to Three. As for us, we were 13 and 14 and went to clubs and heard the DJ mix Big Youth and Treacherous Three. And at any rate, that was Fight for Your Right with the Beastie Boys. You're listening to Waiheke Radio, and here's us, VGs with Civics and Specs. You're with Waiheke Radio and 1001 Songs, and Seth, who is me. Now, that was the Bee Gees with Spicks and Specs. I don't know what you were discerning listeners thought of that. Personally, I think it's a song that really grows on you, actually. Wasn't too keen on it the first time I heard on it, but now I'm beginning to actually see its really quite brilliant side, you know. But Mr. Cresswell, on the other hand, reckons that the Gibb family migrated from Manchester to Australia in 1958, settling in Brisbane. Huey Gibb was a sometime musician. His three tongues took to performing and discovered singing at a local Brisbane car racing event. They were soon in Sydney, appearing on TV. While still a teenager, Barry Gibb was writing songs for other singers, and the Bee Gees were themselves recording artists, although not making much headway in the charts. Nat Kniper, I think that's his name, is an American record producer and songwriter who worked with the Bee Gees in a shed-come studio in the Sydney suburb of Hurstville. Well, I've never been to Sydney, so I don't actually know. The studio was owned by Ozzy Byrne, and the Bee Gees spent a lot of time there working on material. While cutting another track from another singer, Morris Gibb started vamping out a chord progression that he taught Barry that caught Barry Gibb's ear. In less than 20 minutes, he had written a song based on it. Spicks and Specks is a monumental ballad. The Gibb voices climb above a menacing, dramatic piano figure that is coloured by a simple horn line. It was here that Gibb had found the Bee Gees' forte, despite the desperate love song with the heartbreaking male harmonies. Spicks and Specks has a piano part that is so rigid and insistent rhythm that you can't help but feel a force of desire, and then the vocals on top bring home the turmoil. With Spicks and Specks finally breaking into the Australian charts, the Bee Gees were ready to board the Fair Ski and return to England and thereafter conquer the world. Now, next up, we've got Angie, the Rolling Stones, which, you know, appears on their album Goat's Head Soup from 1973. And despite years of speculation on the matter, it's unlikely that the song Angie is evidence that Mick Jagger was having an affair with Bowie's wife, Angela, or indeed that David Bowie. Keith Richards suggested that the title because it came to him with the tune. Richard's second child, Dandelion, who was born around this time, was later called Angie, and there is a personal connection for the title. This would seem to be the more likely source. Angie is one of the better Rolling Stones ballads, with a lush melody and a vulnerable Mick Jagger singing. The entire album was written and recorded in 2 months between tours. Well, while there might not have been a close relationship between the principals, the group itself were in sharp form. Goat's Head Soup was the beginning of a new era. The Stones were now more complex and less sure of themselves. The centre was lost, but there were still flashes of brilliance on such as Goat's Head Soup, a record that has improved with age like a fine cheese. I sort of remember the album Exile on Main Street being done in France and also in the United States. And after going on tour and becoming more complacent and thinking, it's 72, fuck it, we've done it. Mick Jagger once confessed, we still tried after that, but I don't think the results were that wonderful. Maybe people liked Goat's Head Soup, it's only rock and roll and black and blue, but basically those albums do not represent the best of the Rolling Stones. I'm not very good at Mick Jagger because I can't do the little dance that he does, you know. But suffice it to say that you are listening to... I'm Seth, and you are listening to Waiheke Radio and 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, the artist stories and the secrets behind them as selected by Australian music journalist Toby Cresswell. It is Here is Angie by the Rolling Stones. Ganji by the Rolling Stones. You're listening to Waiheke Radio on 88.3 and 107.4 FM, also available on the internet at www.waihekeradio.org.nz/listen. Now, interesting thing about Mick Jagger. I was watching QI last night, you know, with Stephen Fry. I love Stephen Fry, but what they were saying about Mick Jagger is that he's pretty much arseless. He has no buttocks, and they dissected the subject matter as how his trousers stay up with no buttocks. It's quite a fascinating exercise in mechanics. But anyway, that was Angie by the Rolling Stones. Next up, what we've got here is Rage Against the Machine. I don't know how that appeals to you, but we've got Rage Against the Machine here and Killing in the Name. And Mr. Criswell says, wow, these guys were angry. The cover of their eponymous first album pictured a Buddhist monk on fire. Charming. But Rage didn't go in for that kind of passive aggression. Guitarist and Harvard graduate Tom Morello and singer Zach De La Rocha were both second-generation militant leftists who saw Rage as a vehicle for insurgency as well as entertainment. Morello, drummer Brad Wilk, and bass player Tim Comerford and De La Rocha were familiar with rap, hip-hop, heavy rock, and fused styles with the Soldier of Righteous Indignation, but they could also play. Morello especially found a new language for the electric guitar, capricious and vengeful, and just plain gobsmacking in its virtuosity. Yeah, I often was impressed by the guitar lines on that song, actually. But anyway, throughout the course of my guitar playing, I've seen a lot of bands I've been in. He said, much of it was in search of my voice on the instrument to find a unique way to express the anxiety and rage of suburbia through six strings and a piece of wood. And basically, I began to really find that in Rage Against the Machine.
Killing in the Name was the centerpiece of the debut album, an rallying call for millions of angry young men and women in the chorus, "Fuck you, I don't want you to tell me." Rage Against the Machine not only made two proper albums in 6 years, but for the most part due to internal conflicts. After them, however, the deluge of rap rockers such as Linkin Park, Limp Bizkit and Korn, none of them had the depth or wit of Rage Against the Machine, which I suppose is what, you know, they say rap rockers, you know, is because they it's called that because there was a mistake in the printing press and the C fell off the beginning. And that's probably where that idea comes from. But anyway, Rage Against the Machine. Although now there is a tradition of political hardcore and hardcore nor heavy metal, such a System of a Down that is Rage's legacy. Sorry, I got a bit lost there. Neither hip-hop nor hardcore nor heavy metal, Rage Against the Machine were completely uncompromising in their politics and in their music. So there you go, and here you go again. If the machine will do its thing, will machine, oh machine, will you do your thing? Will you do it? Thank you, machine. I'm eternally grateful.
Killing in the name of you. Now you do what they told 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 you. Are the same that brought crosses. Some of those that work forces are the same that brought crosses. Some of those that work forces are the same that brought crosses. You do what they told you. Now 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 you do what they told you.
How are you angry men and women feeling out there? You're probably not really angry men and women, are you? Probably just mild-mannered little squirts like me. But anyway, that was Rage Against the Machine and Killing in the Name. You're with Waiheke Radio here on 107.4 and 88.3 FM. And I'm Seth, and this is 1001 Songs, the greatest songs of all time, and the artists, stories, and the secrets behind them, as selected by Toby Cresswell. Now, next up, we've got a little bit more political mumbo-jumbo. I don't know how that appeals to you, but that's what we've got here at Waiheke Radio. This one is Billy Bragg, and this particular track is called Levi Stubbs Tears, and it's from 1986. The Levi Stubbs of the title is the singer in the Four Tops. The oddly affecting song tells the story of a working class woman who marries too young to the wrong man and finds herself desperate, alone, and miserable, with only the sound of Motown to comfort her. When the world falls apart, there are some things that stay in place. Levi Stubbs Tears run down on his face. Oh no, he sings it. Well, I actually
I'm not actually sure how that particular bit of the song goes, but have a look, listen out for those lines. I'll tell you them again. When the world falls apart, some things stay in place. Levi Stubbs's tears run down his face. That's Billy Bragg, accompanied only by his electric guitar, and that too adds to the oddness. It's something very crucial and missing beyond tunefulness. Bragg just has the emotion of the song. "Yeah, I listen to tapes and I'm sure I'm singing flat in all the songs," he said. "I want to sing like I talk, so I'm never going to be a great singer. I don't think I have to sing in tune all the time for the lyrics to come across. It would be nice, but it becomes behind a few other priorities. It's like what you wear on stage. Does it matter?" Bragg made his name as a radical left-wing songwriter and pamphleteer. So Levi Stubbs's tears, which drips with sentimentality, sounds odd, out of place alongside the workers' marching anthems. Its context on this album raises questions about how art, especially escapist art, functions, and the song is decidedly and correctly ambiguous. On the face of it, Levi Stubbs' tears should be a forgotten novelty, but it remains a powerful and disturbing song. And I'm about to turn the page here, but oh, that's right, the article doesn't actually go onto the next page, which I'm sure is a terrible relief for you all, ladies and gentlemen. So, anyway, here's Billy Bragg and Levi Stubbs' tears coming up for you now.
Money from her accident, she bought herself a mobile home, so at least she could get some enjoyment out of being alone. No one could say that she was left up on the shelf. It's she and me against the world, keep she mumbled to herself. When the world falls apart, something sighing lies. Levi Stubbs' tears run down his face. She ran away from home in her mother's best coat. She was married before she was even entitled to vote. Her husband was one of those blokes, the sort who only laughs at his own jokes. The civil war takes her away, and when there wasn't a war, he left anyway. When the world falls apart, something staying lies. Levi Stubbs' tears run down his face. Hole in her body when I hold she believe. He lets her mother see him walking out the door, and now they stitch her back together. They left her heart in pieces on the floor. And the world falls apart, something stays in place. She takes off the four-touch tape and puts it back in its case. And the world falls apart, something stays in place. Levi Stubbs' tears. Thank you.
Billy Bragg there, and Levi Stubbs' Tears. I think I did actually mention some lyrics or something to you that you were meant to listen out for or something, you know, one of those little trivia things that they do. I can't tell you what they were because I can't actually find them in the paragraph that they were mentioned in Toby Cresswell's marvellous book 1001 Songs. Anyway, I mean, I did moan a bit about Toby Cresswell's love of political mumbo jumbo. I mean, I don't mind a bit of political mumbo jumbo, but what he's given us next, you know, this musical miracle of Madonna on her and her eloquently titled track Music, which appears on the eloquently titled album Music from 2000. On 1998's Ray of Light, Madonna embraced techno. On Music 2 years later, she pushed that button harder. She enlisted French producer... Oh, dear, don't ask me to pronounce that. I'm sorry, I'm still brushing up on my foreign languages here, who introduced other tones and flavours, a tougher edge to the grooves, and more hip-hop fields. Madonna was on a voyage of discovery that ran through her entire career, so it's misleading to see that her changes in terms of reinvention. Music was a delight, sparkling, witty, and more carefree than she had been since her downtown days of the mid-80s. I feel like an animal that's, like, ready to be sprung from a cage. She talked... I can't remember how she speaks. I haven't actually heard her speak. It's funny. Madonna, I can't remember having heard her speak. But that's what she told The Face at the time that the LP was released. I've been living a pretty low-key domestic existence. And I like, miss things. Like, I miss performing and dancing and being on the road and that kind of energy. So part of the record is about that. And the other part is hopefully about love. And so there's a frivolous side of my life, and there's the hopefully non-frivolous side of my life. And I usually make the record that's one or the other, and I feel I did both on this one, but anyway, you have a listen and you see how Madonna's track appeals to you. You're with Waiheke Radio on 88.3 and 107.4 FM. We're also streaming live on waihekeradio.org.nz/listen. I'm Seth, and this is 1001 Songs, the greatest songs of all time, and the artist stories and the secrets behind them, as selected by Toby Cresswell. And here's that wonderful track by Madonna called Music. I mean, I don't know, anyway, that's the track here, and I'll have a listen. Oh, it's live. I forgot to tell you that. We'll be right back. That is one hell of a boring song when you're sitting in a studio down. But that was Madonna. I've got to say that she sounded... that was actually live at Hyde Park, in case you hadn't picked that up. But she sounds quite desperate during that trek, don't you think? I mean, I think that she might have missed her calling as a primary school teacher. She could have been infinitely more successful. Not that she isn't. In fact, she's very successful. She might have even been more successful if she just spent her life writing books on education. I don't know. I mean, that's one of the things we'd have to... That's one of the things we'd have to explore in a parallel universe. At any rate, you are listening to Waiheke Radio on 88.3 and 107.4 FM, depending on where you are on the island. And it is 10 to 8 here on this Monday evening. And I am Seth. And this is 1001 Songs, the greatest songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, as selected by Toby Cresswell. I don't know how many times I've said that this evening, but it's getting a bit wearing. Did I say quarter to eight? Eight minutes to nine. Well, that's the time. If anyone wants to know the time, if anyone's stuck down the bottom of a hole in Mount Maunganui and wants to know the time, it is 8 minutes to nine right now. Now, up next for you, I've got The Replacements and Merry-Go-Round. The Replacements were known as a hard-drinking band, and that was part of their shambolic charm, actually. Then Paul Westerberg, the singer, songwriter, and the guitarist, resolved to get himself sober and move on from the group. For contractual and personal reasons, however, All Shook Down, which is effectively a Westerberg solo album, became The Replacements' swan song. It had been a long decade for Westerberg. The group was lauded all round the globe in some great rock and roll bands of all time. Success, however, eluded them. By 1990, Westerberg was tired and burnt out. His personal life was in upheaval. He was tired of the responsibility of leading a band, and he was also moving away from the replacement sound in search of something more personal and intimate. And we can see how that manifests itself in this track once I just sort of move myself and provide you a running commentary as I move myself around to push the button on the... There we go. I did that for you. Lucky me.
A hush was the first word you were taught, and they watched you wear the clothes they claim that they bought. They brought you down to watch a merry-go-round.
your little hot pan, and I wash your pieces off the ground.
Was the Replacements and Merry Go Round off their 1990 album All Shook Down. You're listening to Waiheke Radio 88.3 or 107.4 FM, also streaming live on the net on waihekeradio.org.nz/listen. 1001 songs, the greatest songs of all time, and the artists, the stories and the secrets behind them, as selected by Toby Cresswell. You can actually listen to that with Seth. Why am I talking about myself in the third person? This is really quite bizarre, actually. Well, that's what I think anyway. But anyway, that is what the show is called, and I am Seth. And it is nearly the end of the show, actually, but I think we might just have time for one more track. I've got you Cold Chisel and Goodbye Astrid here from 1978. Jimmy Barnes wrote all three chords, and Don Walker wrote the lyrics to this classic small piece of misogyny. At the time of writing, Cold Chisel was, to all intents and purposes, five Adelaide boys going nowhere fast and loudly so, living in a dive hotel rooms and playing three sets a night in any bar that would have them. Chisel lived the rock and roll dream. What set them apart, however, was their impeccable taste in dirty rock and roll. Astrid was a 12-bar thrash in the style of Trogs, although even with a tune as rudimentary as this, Chisel brought a unique touch, foremost as Ian Moss's sandpaper guitar lines. Don Walker's tale of marriage and breakup is full of wit and attitude. There's no melancholic, wistful sense of lost possibility. Just 7 years of give a little, take a little, and put a little money away. The Australian version of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. The narrator lets fly his scorn for the woman's lifestyle. All the bottled-up anger spews out, and all the feelings he's suppressed are vomited up. And turn up the tears, and make sure that you let your neighbours see. What a lay-down deal you got when you married me. Astrid lent itself
to the full force of Chisel on stage. Ian Moss's breakneck guitar leading the way for a slightly swinging rhythm section of Steve Prestwich's versatile drumming and Phil Small's solid bass with Walker Jerry Lee Lewis piano playing. Then there was Jimmy Barnes, who let fly on the song like his life depended on it. His vocal here was a tsunami of emotion, way beyond the usual scope of rock and roll and completely his own. Cold Chisel wrote more literate songs and more sophisticated tunes, but taking these three chords in a simple story and transforming them into a unique and confronting piece like this takes a real genius.